I'm convinced that a society that has been robbed of the tools of self-understanding cannot move forward.
Coming up on In Contrast, a look inside Russia today with Masha Gessen. Amilan Stavans and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Masha Gessen was born in Moscow and moved to New York as a teenager in 1981. She returned to Moscow as a journalist 10 years later. She is a contributor to The New Yorker, and she is also the author of 9 books, including The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, which won a National Book Award in 2017, and The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Gessen is the recipient of a number of fellowships, including one from the Guggenheim Foundation, another one from the Andrew Carnegie Foundation, and one from the Nieman Foundation. She is currently a visiting professor at Amherst College. Masha Gessen, thank you for coming to In Contrast. It's a pleasure to have you. I want to start with focusing on your book, The Future is History. It is an extraordinary tapestry of lives, mainly half a dozen lives in contemporary Russia, and you use these individuals as a stepping stones to understand their milieu, their connections, their family relationships, and the way ideas have changed profoundly in each individual and also in the larger scope of what Russia is. Somewhere at the beginning of the book, you talk about them as characters. And so I wanted to start, Masha, with a question of objectivity and subjectivity of the journalists. To what extent the selection of these individuals that you have put in here that serve as your anchor and eventually become your map of the landscape is a statement of who you are and might entail some exclusions of others, other voices, or some curating? I want to know what the process of coming up with these characters, your involvement with these characters, your coming to know them so well, and how much of you is in all of that.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to talk to you about how I chose these people to interview. I really want to set aside terms like objectivity and subjectivity in journalism, which I think are extremely unhelpful terms. We can discuss them separately, but I don't want to answer the question about these characters framed in terms of objectivity and subjectivity. I just don't think it's a good prism through which to look at journalism. When I was figuring out how I was going to structure the book, I had a couple of objectives. One was I wanted to write it the way a novel is written. And I wanted to write it the way a novel is written, not because I think it's literally pretty, but because I think that novels do something that conventional nonfiction writing doesn't, which is also not to knock conventional nonfiction writing. I've written 9 books in this sort of conventional nonfiction style and probably will write more. I'm not wedded to this way of writing. I thought this way of writing was right for this book because I wanted to do 2 things. I wanted to break the distance from which nonfiction is usually written. Your standard journalism is written from what I think of as the middle distance. It's like the journalist is standing somewhere close to the subject, but not too close, and certainly not inside, or at least the journalist tries not to stay inside the subject, but also not too far. And so with most nonfiction, you get a close-up view, but not too close, and you never get the bird's eye view. With a novel, you get the interior view, and you get the bird's eye view. And this is where I will reference the great Russian novel, but there's the sort of the peace parts, where you're inside characters' heads, and then there are the war parts, where you're looking at the movement of troops. So that's what I wanted to do. Which is not to say that I'm comparing myself to Tolstoy, but to say that's the ultimate achievement of the Russian novel, is the switch between the interior and the bird's eye view. So I wanted to look at Russia through the eyes of characters that fall into 2 groups. One is for people who were born in the mid-1980s, and I wanted that because I've been obsessed for many years with the condition of having grown up in the 90s. You know, we talk a lot about the 90s, and people who work on Russia argue about the 90s. Were the 90s the best of times, the worst of times? Were they a time of chaos and violence, as Putin would have you believe? Or were they a time of the blossoming of democracy and high hopes and actual birth of politics in Russia? And of course, they were all of those things. But they were all of those things for adults. For children, I think the predicament was quite different. Because whether your parents thought it was chaotic and scary and violent or inspiring and exhilarating and wide-opening, you lived in a world in which your parents were unstable. And the only place of certainty was what was on television, Soviet propaganda that stayed on television and in children's books and actually all around you. the place of moral certainty was that communist past that hadn't been debunked. There was no decommunization. So I've really been obsessed with that tension for a long time and what that did to people who came of age then, who became adults under Putin or around the time that Putin came to power. And then the second group are intellectuals, and that goes to my other obsession, which is I'm convinced that a society that has been robbed of the tools of self-understanding cannot move forward. And so I have a philosopher, a psychoanalyst, and a sociologist who are people who are struggling to reclaim these tools of self-understanding.
And those tools of self-understanding have been robbed by the very process of development. What's at the root of that robbery?
Well, at the root of that robbery is actually an explicit Bolshevik policy of obliterating the humanities. There were different reasons for obliterating different parts of the humanities. Certainly, bourgeois philosophy was dangerous and unnecessary because there was one true philosophy, which was Marxism-Leninism, which is quite different from Marxist critical thinking. It's this dogma, pseudo-scientific dogma of Marxism-Leninism. Psychology and psychoanalysis in particular were unnecessary because of the project of creating the new man in a new society was successful. Then the man lived in perfect harmony with society at all times. Their objectives and the society's objectives were always congruent. And if they weren't, then there was a pathology, either criminal pathology, in which case you have jail, or psychiatric pathology, in which case you have a mental hospital. So you can't, by definition, in that vision, have any kind of inner conflict. So you don't need psychologists and psychoanalysts. And sociology, there's a longer and more interesting story in a way, because Lenin had a personal gripe against sociology. And sociology, he thought it was a pseudoscience. Sociology was essentially banned. There was this sort of attraction aversion problem with sociology because the Soviet authorities wanted to know what was going on in their society. You don't have elections if you don't have any democratic mechanisms. You can't actually know what people think and want or even how they live. At the same time, they couldn't collect that data without employing sociologists. But if sociologists were in place to collect the data, then they would have the data. That would make them the most informed and dangerous people in the Soviet Union. So there was this very complicated relationship, and there was a little tiny bit of sociology that then blossomed.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier on about what the novelist is able to achieve, the outer world and the inner world, the internal life of the characters. And it seems to me as a reader of the Futurist history that though written from a journalistic perspective, one is able, if not to hear the inner dialogue of a character, but at least understand the inner life of the character that drives them in this direction or that in reaction or looking for hope in one way or another. And that takes an intimate closeness. You were talking about that relative closeness, that middle ground with the characters, to the point that it's almost as if you are following them with a camera that both sees them from the outside but internalizes them and sees them from within. What crosses my mind as a writer and as a reader is that there must have been hours and hours of this proximity that you must have spent with them.
You're, of course, right. And I'm really glad that you're using the analogy of the camera because that was the effect that I was going for. I wanted it to be a movie, and I wanted it to be a movie in which no one ever walks across the camera, right? So one of the criteria for the selection of these characters was that they had to be willing to spend endless hours with me answering really inane questions. And they couldn't just tolerate these inane questions. They had to have an investment in it as well. So with two people in particular, with Lyosha and Masha, I think it was an important process for both of us. They agreed to sit with me and answer questions about what was on television at that moment, what it smelled like, and what the next frame was, and then what he saw at the window, and then what that felt like, and what this felt like, so that I could render it as inner monologue. And you can only do that if you're also getting something out of it. So I think for Lyosha, especially because this is a young man who I trace his life from birth to last year, he was a young academic in Perm. He was a very brilliant young academic who started the first LGBT studies center at a Russian university and then was forced to flee for his life. And we started talking very soon after he landed in the United States. And I think that for him, sort of talking through his life was an important part of the transition to a new life and a new country. And I think for Masha, another character, there was a similar process of sort of taking stock. So I hope I was useful to them and didn't just exploit them for the purposes of this book.
Novelists sometimes talk about reaching a point in the process of writing where they are no longer in control of the characters, but the characters are in control of them, so to speak. There are famous moments in which I think of one of Gabriel Garcia Marquez coming and crying next to his wife because the main character, Aureliano Buendía of 100 Years of Solitude, had finally died and he didn't think he would ever die. So I wonder, in the role that you have as a journalist, the connection that you have to your various characters, and this liaison that you create of intimacy and of mutual dependency, if it also translates into the responsibility of you of saying certain things that they want to see reflected in the book, meaning they can control you, and of you pushing them in directions that they might not want to do, but that for narrative purposes, it would be useful if you did go there. So how do you navigate as a journalist this difficult psychological part?
That's actually sort of standard fare in journalism. You're always involved in that negotiation. You're particularly involved in that negotiation if you're writing about people who are not ordinarily public people. So that's been true for me throughout my career. You don't have to be writing this particular kind of novelistic book to come up against those issues. In a way, this was a little simpler because from the outset, we knew that the contract was to write about innermost thoughts and personal issues, including personal life, including sex, including intimate details. There are things that aren't in the book because they involve other people and because there's a really important thing that's not in the book, a really important aspect of one of the characters' lives that couldn't be in the book because it involved other people. And I wrote around it the way you might talk around something in life because you can't disclose something because it's someone else's secret. I don't think it damages the book, but the book would be so much richer if I could disclose that particular circumstance, but I can't. At another instance, when I was interviewing Marina Rotunyan, who's the psychoanalyst, the contract with the intellectuals in the book was a little bit different. I was there to write about their intellectual path and their ideas. But as Marina and I talked, it became clear to me that her family story was also important. It was the best example of what I was trying to get at. But it wasn't a patient's family story. It was her family story. And so I asked for permission to go there, and then we scheduled a separate interview. With Marina, we talked on Skype once a week for about a year, for an hour. It was sort of this reversal of the psychoanalytic hour. And every time I would say, our time is coming to an end, and next time I would like to talk to you about blank. So I asked for permission, and she said, yeah, you can ask me about that. And so we scheduled a session to talk about that.
I want to continue for a second, Masha, on the idea of the camera and of the cinematic presentation that you offer of a Russia with its anchors, that many of them being born in the 80s. The fact that you live a dual life linguistically strikes me as crucial here. You are communicating with many of them, I assume, in one language, and then delivering the narrative in another language. And that entails a process of translation, of self-translation, or of translation. So I wonder if you can talk to me about your relationship with the Russian language. Does English represent something for you? You can say things in English that you can't in Russian, and vice versa. Do you feel more intimate with one than in the other?
Well, it depends on who I'm talking to. If I'm speaking to a Russian speaker about intimate things, then Russian is more intimate.
Would this book have been dramatically different had it been written in Russian?
Oh, this is a book written in English. So it's not a book that could be written in Russian.
It's a book written in English. For an English language audience.
It's a book written in the English language for an English language audience. These things are inseparable.
Has it been thought, or is it forthcoming, a Russian edition?
No.
And that because?
Of all of my books, only one has been translated into Russian. It's a book about a mathematician. And even then, I got into trouble because I wrote that the greatest Russian mathematician, probably of all time, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time in the world, Andrei Kolmogorov, was gay. It was not a secret. My conclusion that he was gay was based on his published correspondence with his partner of 50 years, Pavel Alexandrov. And yet, many people, not everybody, but many people felt that I had somehow defamed his memory by actually putting a word on it.
The subtitle of your book is How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. In one of the main aspects that you investigate is the life of democracy in it, the attempts to live in a democratic way. Is democracy possible in Russia?
If you're asking if the Russian people are just genetically incapable of democracy, then I reject that premise. I mean, most nations in the world, most democratic societies were not democratic before they became democratic, with just a couple of exceptions in the New World. I don't think there's anything essential to the Russian character, or whatever you want to call it, that prevents democracy. At the same time, what the book is about is the trauma of 70 years of totalitarianism. That has nothing to do with national character as an essential biological or whatever concept. It has everything to do with how societies function in response to this bizarre extreme experiment, which is not in some ways dissimilar to the way that people function in response to extreme trauma. They adjust, they find ways to survive. The way to survive in a totalitarian society for individuals and groups was to create mechanisms of horizontal enforcement, was to engage in doublethink, to always try to predict any shift in ideological winds so as to stay ahead of the curve, because it was a matter of survival. And there's nothing particularly surprising, and there's certainly nothing predetermined about those skills being passed on from generation to generation.
How does one foster the possibility of democracy thriving again? If you were talking before about those in the humanities, the absence of those tools or mechanisms of critical thinking, when totalitarianism serves by limiting the scope of that critical thinking, how can that be advanced? What are the changes that need to occur?
Well, it's a huge question. It's a huge problem. There needs to be sort of fundamental reform of the education system. And by fundamental reform, I mean not just introducing, you know, new disciplines well taught into the universities, but introducing the possibility of children thinking for themselves. When I first came to this country as a teenager, I came here when I was 14. 2 years later, I started going to college. I was going to college to study architecture. And so in my very first class, there was a very simple assignment. You know, we were given some balsa wood and told to create a model little house or little dwelling on a particular sort of piece of landscape. So I built what I thought was a very elegant solution. And the professor came around to my station and said, okay, that's a very elegant solution. Now do something else. And I thought, well, why? If this isn't the right solution, if he said it's an elegant solution, then it's the right solution. If he wants me to do something else, then it must not be the right solution. I couldn't figure out what he was talking about. It took me another few years, and I was a teenager. And I had already been in this country for a couple of years by that point. And I had grown up in a dissident family. And yet it was so sort of deeply ingrained in my thinking that there was only one right solution to any problem. Now that, if you think about it, actually is a fundamentally undemocratic idea. The idea that there's only one right solution to any problem is the enemy of democracy. Democracy is finding the best possible solution under the circumstances. It's finding compromises. It's reconciling different needs, different beliefs, different preferences. None of that is ever going to produce the perfect solution. And so the idea, that sort of confrontation that I had with my first architecture professor, is actually a very good example of how that mentality of the perfect solution doesn't work.
In that anecdote that you're presenting that is fabulously enlightening, there was this moment of flash that I've already produced this. Could you tell me what happened to you after that in the next classes for you to transition from the idea that there was only one solution to things to seeing that the idea of having multiple solutions is attractive? I'm interested in that mental process of abandoning the sacred truth, the absolute truth, the conviction that there's only one, to living with other possibilities that might compete with one another and depend on circumstance.
Oh, that's still a work in progress. No, that was 34 years ago, but it's still a work in progress.
Let's talk about the role that put in place in the American imagination today? I have heard you say that we might be putting too much attention into the Russian meddling in the election. I am inferring of all this that the size of Putin in certain minds is overdone. The roots of this obsession in the West, Masha?
You know, I think that conspiracy theories are born when we can't make sense of something, when the unimaginable happens. So I think that for a lot of people, the election of Donald Trump to be the 45th president of the United States was unimaginable. And that created the need for a simple narrative that could explain how this could have happened. And Putin serves that purpose. Evil Putin meddled in the election, and that's how we got Donald Trump. Now, I'm not saying that he didn't meddle, and I'm definitely not saying that he's not evil. What I'm saying is that explanation is too simple and really not useful, because what ultimately happened is that Americans elected Donald Trump. Whether meddling played a role in it, whether it played a decisive role, in a sense doesn't matter to understanding what happened. Even if he had lost, we would be living in a country where tens of millions of people voted for Donald Trump. That in itself is something that demands a reckoning. And the successive focus on Russia and its role in the election delays that reckoning.
In a recent comment by Putin, he made mention of Jews using them as scapegoats. And I want to talk to you about, since the arrival of Donald Trump in the United States, there has been a spike, an increase in antisemitism in this country and antisemitism in Europe as well. This is many decades after the end of World War II. And the use of antisemitism appears to be, again, playing an important role in populist regimes. Can you tell me a bit about antisemitism these days in Russia?
Oh, you know what? It's a tricky question for me, because antisemitism is always there. Sometimes it's blatant. Sometimes it hides beneath a veneer of civility. But I don't feel right talking about antisemitism in Russia, because, you know, Russia is a country that's waging a deadly war on its LGBT population. Russia is a country that has been waging a deadly war on the Muslim populations in the Northern Caucasus for 24 years now. And, you know, there shouldn't be sort of an oppression Olympics, but Jews have done pretty well compared to the Soviet period when I grew up, when you couldn't gain admission to university, there was systematic discrimination, you couldn't work in a number of professions, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is gone, right? State-enforced anti-Semitism is gone. It's very much present in the culture. My position has always been, you know what, I can deal with the culture as long as the state is not discriminating against me. And I do think that structural issue is no longer there. It could be reinstated very, very quickly, but that's not what's happening. That structural issue is there for Chechens, for Ingush, for other Muslim populations of the North Caucasus. It's there for migrant workers, of whom there are millions in Russia, and it's there for LGBT people.
Recently, Vladimir Putin was reelected once again, and there seems to be a kind of a resignation in the West that this is the way things are going to look in Russia for quite some time. There is, on the other hand, a certain projection that comes out from Russia that Putin connects with a certain segment of the population that is enthralled by his presence and by the way he has been leading the country. Do you think that this next term will be in any way different? Is Putin becoming more Putinized, so to speak?
It's a good way of putting it. Yes, I do. I don't love predictions, and you're never remembered for good predictions. You're always remembered for the mistakes you make when predicting something. But I have great fear of Putin's fifth unofficial term. It's legally his last term for the time being. Many ways that he can work around it. But it creates a kind of anxiety. I think that, oddly, he has some sense of his own illegitimacy, and that sense is intensifying, and it can only produce an even greater crackdown. I mean, there has been a political crackdown underway in Russia now for 6 years, since 2012, since the election of 2012, which happened amid mass protests. And as soon as Putin was quote-unquote reelected, he started cracking down. I think that after this election there, the crackdown will intensify because of this inner crisis of legitimacy.
What do you envision being the relationship between Trump and Putin in this next term?
I'm not optimistic about that relationship. Here's a prediction I made. I predicted that the Trump-Putin relationship would have the shortest honeymoon in history. And I think I was right. It never even started. I mean, he actually would have preferred to deal with Hillary Clinton. To him, certainly, the idea of a woman president was very upsetting, but she would have been tough and predictable, whereas Trump is erratic and unpredictable. And Putin has largely capitalized on his own behavior as the madman on the international stage. But now there's an actual madman who's not performing on the international stage, and Putin has to contend with him.
Who's an usurper in some ways.
I'm sorry?
Who's an usurper in some ways, like pushing him.
Yes. So I think that for Putin, this is a destabilizing and unhappy situation. And at the same time, Trump, for whatever reason, is not as easily manipulated as he expected him to be.
We're coming here to the end, Masha, and I want to ask you one last question. Could you envision, and I know you resist giving any prophetic messages mm-hmm. here, but a time when a woman could lead Russia?
You know, it's in order for anything to happen in Russia, there has to be regime change. It's not just that Putin has to leave. There has to be a reconstitution of electoral institutions, a reconstitution of media, a restoration of public space. If that ever were to happen, I don't have a lot of hope for that happening, but if that ever were to happen, we'd be dealing with, living with, whatever, a completely different country. Anything would be possible then.
And at that point, something like that could be possible.
Sure, anything would be possible.
Thank you very much for coming to In Contrast. It's been a
Thank
pleasure.
You. Thank you for having me.
Journalists not only deliver the news, they are not only chroniclers of the time in which they live. Journalists are also thermometers measuring the winds of freedom and justice. For to narrate what is happening in the present, to do so accurately, with conviction and without fear, one needs courage. Not surprisingly, journalists are murdered every year, and not only in regimes ruled by tyrants. That's easy to understand. Those in power don't want the truth out. They want to control what is known and what isn't. Journalists, for them, are unwelcome clarions. Their blood is spilled with impunity. A bullet finds them in a dark corner, or their bodies wash up on the riverbank. But journalists are also targeted in democracies. There, the methods of getting rid of them are different. The way to do it is questioning their validity, or by making them irrelevant. How? Through noise. Lots of noise. Journalism is irrelevant when readers are distracted with other things. I call that type of assassination death by excess. That's what consumerism does. It makes us lose our sense of priority. It drowns the voices that matter. It kidnaps the truth. It has been said that journalists are historians of the present. They offer the first take on events as those events are unfolding. Historians will look at the present with more patience. They will have more time at their disposal. Journalists don't have that much time. Their duty is to explore what's ephemeral. Their task is to sort out things as they are getting entangled. Journalism, in its neutrality, is a form of resistance. It might or might not be political. In the end, that doesn't matter. What matters is that it is intelligible, that it doesn't have the length of a soundbite, that it is informed and speaks to our intelligence, and that it stands up to power, regardless of who holds the helms of that power. A fine journalist is a sharp writer who comes to the recognition that reality is the best kind of fiction, and that that fiction needs to be narrated as is, in all its shameful dimensions. A fine journalist writes not only for the present, but for the past, as well as for the future. Next time on In Contrast.
I do feel, as African-American women in this nation, the historical legacy of social and racial injustice is not something that I get to escape on any day and any level.
The Art of Sonia Clark. Next time on In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns are Delina Hatku and Jacob Pagano. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.